honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in light of Holocaust Remembrance Day, or as they officially call the start of that observation at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, Holocaust Martyrs and Heroes Day. In a moment, we're going to hear recollections from a decorated U.S. soldier who fled his native Germany because of the Holocaust and later donated some of his mementos to Yad Vashem as well as the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. But first, one more brief excerpt from this week's ceremony. You can watch it in its entirety at hometownheroesradio.com. This is the Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, speaking in Hebrew with an English translator.
Hi, v'achayotai. Brothers and sisters, the Holocaust is an unprecedented event in human history. I am stating this fact because as the years go by, we hear some people in the world comparing other difficult events to the Holocaust. But no. Even the most difficult wars today are not the Holocaust and are nothing like the Holocaust. No event in history, cruel as it may be, comes close to the extermination of European Jews by the Nazis and their collaborators.
Some of the points made this week on Holocaust Remembrance Day by Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, speaking at Yad Vashem, where if you visit today, you could find items donated by Oscar Rice, a groundbreaking scientist who would eventually help identify the biomarkers for prostate cancer. If you've ever taken a PSA test, he's one of the people you have to thank. Oscar would earn the Silver Star and the Purple Heart during his World War II service with the 79th Infantry Division in Europe, a fight that for him was not just patriotic, but also intensely personal. Oscar grew up in a Jewish family in the suburbs of Munich.
Interestingly enough, I went, of course, to a Catholic grammar school. But then Hitler, in 33 or 4, decreed that Jews had to go to Jewish schools. So then I went to an Orthodox Jewish school in Munich. And then after that, after I graduated, I went to Altes Real Gymnasium, which is the same thing as a high school, but much more advanced. So until Hitler gave in the full power, till 35, 36, there was no problem go to the school. But the Hitler youth started to really harass me, us, the Jewish people. In wintertime, they throw snowballs at us that had an accident. And I went to school in a bicycle. They were in the air of the bicycle, ruining the bicycles too. And then one of the Hitler youth that sat behind me was carrying a long knife, stick the knife in my back and said, when there were tests, especially math tests, where I was very good at, let's change tests.
Wow.
So my father said, you got to get out of here. So I applied both for a visa to the United States and for a visa to go to Palestine. I had a very close friend, high school friend, Richard Blatchest. When I got the visa to come to the United States, I wanted to go with him, of course. But my mother says, you're going to the United States. So at 17, in those days, you don't disagree with your parents.
Well, yeah, but they're telling you it's not safe for you here. You have to go to America. You don't speak any English.
Yeah.
So you're sailing across the Atlantic Ocean.
But she knew where I was going because her aunt, who sponsored me, had connections with the ag school I went to.
An ag school that's now called Delaware Valley
University.
What you studied there was how to be a dairyman, right?
Well, that was my major. I also learned how to do other work, like to plow fields and spray orchard. They had five different departments. What helped me with my English was the head of floriculture had got his degree from Heidelberg University and was fluent in German. So as long as I was with him in the department, he helped me with my language.
So you picked up English pretty quick.
Yes. In 6 months, I was all right.
So you're over here. Your whole family is still in Germany. You're studying at this basically agricultural school, National Farm School it was called then. You end up getting out of there and running a dairy. But over this time period, how often did you hear from your family back home?
Very rarely.
You had to be concerned about him, knowing what Hitler was about.
Of course. And then I asked my aunt to also give him visas, and she applied for it. But by the time the mail got to my parents, the American embassy in Stuttgart had closed because of the war, and there was nothing to be done anymore.
And if your parents had waited a year, 2 years longer, you might not have made it to America.
Right.
But your little sister did.
Yeah. She went through southern France, but she was so traumatized that she didn't remember how the whole thing happened.
Your parents had the foresight to help you and flee this situation, but they were stuck there.
And my sister, because we had relatives in Alsace-Lorraine, and they sent my sister, after the war has broken out, to Alsace-Lorraine, and then she went to southern France, around Marseille somewhere, and came to the United States.
Yeah, so here, you've graduated from this university, and now you're running a dairy farm in Maryland, not far from Washington, D.C. You did that for a couple years. They didn't need you for the war. They needed you in that job. And then when you decided that you might want to get in this war and go fight the man who's persecuting your family and so many others, they said, no, you can't. You're an enemy.
Yeah.
You have no idea what's happened to your family, right?
No, right. Absolutely no idea.
And you've got both your parents and your brother that are still back there.
And my grandparents.
And your grandparents.
All my grandparents.
And I can't imagine what that feels like, to be completely cut off and no idea and knowing that people are being persecuted and horrible things are happening. But by 1943, they decide, oh, we changed our mind. We need some bodies now.
Well, the reason is that I worked in the creamery, so I wasn't essential anymore.
So since you stopped working at the creamery, you didn't have an exemption anymore?
Well, I don't know. I just got a letter from the draft board.
Uh-huh.
We report for induction.
But you're still not a U.S. citizen.
Nope.
You go into the Army. You're training.
Fort McCallum.
So you're out there shooting a machine gun?
Yeah.
And what did they do? They had you change targets real fast or something?
Yeah.
And they noticed how good you were at that?
Yeah.
Because you were real sharp in math. You could make the adjustments.
Yeah.
And so then they came to talk to you?
Yeah.
And they heard your accent?
Yeah.
What happened then?
Well, he said, we need you in Germany.
He realized you spoke German?
Yeah, fluent German. He says, we need you in Germany.
And he meant right then?
Right there. And he says, we can't send you because you're not a citizen. We got to make you a citizen.
So how'd they do that?
Well, they took me to a courthouse in Anniston, Alabama. The colonel went to see the judge and explained the situation to him. After I filled out all the forms, I went into the judge's chamber, and the judge looked at me and says, do you know anything about the Constitution? And I waved my pamphlet the Army had given me and says, yes, I've read it. And he said, you're a citizen.
Just like that.
And 3 weeks later, I was in Germany.
They put you in the 79th Infantry Division.
Yeah.
You got there right as the Battle of the Bulge is going on,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. We were protecting the right flank of Patton in the Battle of the Bulge.
Now, you had grown up in Germany.
Yeah.
I know. I'm sure you'd had some rough winters.
Oh, yeah.
But what was that like, that winter of 44?
Digging a foxhole was terrible. It wasn't nice, let me put it this way. But I managed all right. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, I told all my companions to not call me Oscar, my first name, because it's so Germanic. I used my middle name, Kully, K-U-L-L-Y.
Uh-huh.
That's my mother's maiden name was Kuhlmann. So that's why I'm Kully. Then I could overhear a lot of the German conversations, which helped us so strategically.
So if you had gone by Oscar, the enemy would have been tipped off and wouldn't have spoken German so freely.
Yeah.
But you're in a combat situation.
Oh, yeah.
You've got the enemy firing at you, and you're firing at them.
Oh, yeah. I went through a night patrol with an American Indian, a corporal. I learned how to behave in the woods at night. He knew his way around. He's the one that taught me how to stay alive under those conditions.
Did you think you were going to stay alive?
I had doubts because we were getting attacked by tanks and all this sort of thing.
And how often? I mean, here you are.
Yeah.
You're back in Europe. You're so close to your family, in theory.
Yeah.
But you still don't know what's happened to them.
Right.
How often did you think about that?
Oh, constantly, of course.
And you're fighting this regime that is the reason you left Germany.
Well, yeah. That had something to do with my motivation. I rewarded the Silver Star.
You mentioned the Silver Star. So this takes place long after the Battle of the Bulge, after you guys, by hook or by crook, made it across the Rhine, which wasn't easy for you. And You're in a foxhole looking out, and what do you see?
I see movement, and I know what people, and in a foxhole, I know it was on the German side, so it must have been Germans.
And how far away were they?
100 yards.
And how many of them were there?
Well, actually, two. The army said three, but there was only two.
And what did you decide to do?
I decided to take my radio off and crawl in a ditch with my carbine that took me within, maybe 5 feet of that foxhole. I got out, cocked my carbine first, of course, jumped out of the foxhole and told them, the Germans, to surrender.
And you said that in German?
In German, yeah.
Yeah.
And they immediately surrendered. Didn't have to do anything.
But that's a long way to crawl. And if you had alerted them somehow with some mistake before you got there, they would have shot you.
Yeah, of course.
So you were taking your life into your hands by doing this.
There's no question about that.
So you tell them to surrender. They do. And you say, now you have to follow me back over here.
Yeah, I follow you.
You force them to go. Yeah, exactly. And you notice something in their possession.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons you got the Silver Star.
Yeah.
Tell me what you found.
I found a German map that had marked clearly the coordinates of the guns that they were using to destroy the pontoon bridge.
And this is why you had such a hard time getting across the Rhine.
Yeah.
They kept blowing up the pontoon bridge or the engineers' efforts to build one.
Yeah.
You discover this map. It's got the gun positions.
We radioed back immediately the coordinates of the gun position.
And what happened next?
The guns started firing.
Not just any guns.
No, those were the kinds of size that the battleships had. They were sitting on the other side of the Rhine. They had to be taken apart. There were no type of guns that couldn't move. There was emplacements.
That's why I'm asking, because when people hear big guns, they think we're talking about maybe at most a 155.
Yeah.
This is a 250?
50 millimeter, yeah. At least that's what they told me. And they had to be taken apart into three pieces to be transported.
But they know exactly where to fire because of the map that you found.
Yeah.
So here you are back in your position, and you've got quite a show to behold.
Yeah.
Tell me what you saw and what you heard.
Well, they told us to get our heads down in the foxhole in case there was a short round, and they started firing for 15 minutes, TOT, time on target, and the shells going overhead sounded like a freight train going overhead. And I learned later, I didn't see the place, but the friends of mine that saw the place where the guns were said they were totally destroyed.
I would imagine so, with artillery of that caliber heading their way. And that's significant. I mean, the reason they're giving you the Silver Star is by capturing these guys, finding that map, they're able to destroy all these guns.
Yeah.
That allows them to get across the Rhine, and it probably saved a lot of American lives.
Sure.
Did you realize that at the time, how significant that was?
No, I didn't. That was a job. You know, when you're on the front line, see what a job that needs to be done. You don't worry about anything else. It's like, how can I get it done and save my life?
Just 3 days after those heroics that earned him the Silver Star, he was wounded by shrapnel from a mortar shell. He always said the radio strapped to his back probably saved his life by protecting his internal organs. But through all of those harrowing days in combat, even crossing back into his native Germany, he still had no report, no information, no final word on what had become of his family there that he'd been forced to leave behind.
No, not until I went to Munich, to the headquarters where all the records were kept, and looked at the records. And I found out later the records were not accurate.
Well, I want to understand what this was like for you. And again, keeping in mind that you're still a very young man. So you're ordered to Nuremberg, and they're going to have you interrogate war criminals because you speak such great German.
Yeah.
Now, these are the war criminals that wanted to kill you and any other Jew they could find.
Yeah.
But to that point, you were okay with that idea.
I was hesitant even then.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say. I was not ready to tell my colonel no.
Sure.
But after seeing the records.
So tell me about this. So you go to Munich, and what's in Munich?
All the records are kept in Munich.
And you mean all the records from the entire Holocaust?
Yeah. They were later transferred to another place, and any correction were made. The Holocaust was the same in Washington. Put me up to that, to go to the records at the other place.
Uh-huh.
To make sure, like they had, my parents were loaded in a cattle train, and in Munich it said they were taken to Riga, Latvia, executed there, but the train never made it to doing it stopped.
What I want to understand is what knowledge you are receiving at the time, because you get to Munich, and here is this vast trove of records. Was it a needle in a haystack to find your family in there?
No. It was filed under my regular name, Rice.
So you look up Rice, and as you get to that spot, is your heart pounding a little bit? Or did you think you already knew what you were going to find?
I think I knew what I was going to find. I had enough stories. When we went across from the Rhine to Czechoslovakia, we were very close to the Belsen concentration.
Bergen-Belsen,
And there, you know, in the army, rumors fly. We knew that it was very bad.
But now you're opening up a file.
Yeah.
And you see right there, and it has your parents' name.
Yeah, it's in here. The only thing that was wrong is that it didn't go to Riga. The gate went to Kaunas.
But you're looking at a paper that says your parents are dead.
Yeah, and my grandparents. My grandparents went to Theresienstadt.
And what about your brother?
Oh, he went with my parents.
What did that do to you, to see that in print?
Oh, it's hard to take, let's put it this way. If I would have had a German that was bothering me, I might have shot him, without question.
So you find out that your parents, your grandparents, your brother are all victims of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're also thinking at some point, that's what would have happened to me.
Sure.
Yet you go back to Nuremberg, and they still expect you to interrogate these guys.
Yeah.
So what'd you do?
I told the colonel I couldn't do it emotionally, and he understood.
You did some things in the Army in World War II that saved fellow soldiers' lives. The lives you most desperately wanted to save, your family, you couldn't because of Hitler. And now, all these years later, you develop a test that, I mean, I have to imagine, has helped save thousands of lives, if not millions.
Well, that's why I went to science, helped do some social work, to try to find out what's going on in your body and what we can do to improve diseases.
Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever tried to quantify how many people have survived or been able to treat prostate cancer because they got warning?
No, I don't know.
Do you think I'm off in my estimate?
I don't think so. It makes me feel proud that I was able to contribute something.
And ultimately, on that end, I guess we have your parents to thank for their foresight in sending you to this country.
Especially my mother, who constantly said to me, get educated. That's something they never can take away from you.
No, they could not. And he did everything he could to make sure memories of the Holocaust would be preserved as well. Oscar Rice honored the memory of his mother and the other members of his family who perished in the Holocaust by planting trees in the Martyrs' Forest outside of Jerusalem. Trees that, like that flame lit by six Holocaust survivors at Yad Vashem this week, serve as powerful reminders of a tragic crime against humanity that we all hope and pray will never be repeated. Thanks for listening to this special edition of Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time for a special Mother's Day episode with a 104-year-old woman whose story of service in World War II is sure to not only turn your head, but also serve as one more reminder that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.